Actually, the origin of this talk is I made a proposal to the ITP for a workshop, which was characterized as at lunch as being ill-considered, which I think is actually correct. It has some ideas that at least I think were interesting in it, and so Tony asked me to give this talk, and so I tried to figure out actually what this topological doping concept that I had proposed meant. So if aspects of this talk are not sufficiently thought through for your taste, that's because they're not. I guess the last calculations I'm going to report were done at 2 o'clock in the morning yesterday. So at any rate, this is an idea that I realized I've been, retroactively realized I've been working on for most of my life with almost everybody I've ever collaborated with, so that's why everybody I've ever collaborated with practically is there, but mostly with Vic Emery and with Leonid Pratko and Dan Hone and Eduardo Fratkin, former student of mine, Oren Zakhar. So here's what I'm going to try to tell you about. First, what does this idea of topological doping mean? And so what I'll start by doing is describing some examples of topological doping and more or less descriptive of what the idea is and how it occurs in certain specific systems. Then I'll get to the issue of why does this happen? What's the mechanism that causes it to happen? And up to there, I think I really have something to say. And then what are its implications for highly correlated materials, which is what I work on, is where there's a lot of room for other contributions. So I'll just outline some of the ideas there. Now, before talking about topological doping, let me tell you what I'm really thinking about. I'm trying to embed it in this broader context, but what I'm really thinking about and what I think these ideas have relevance to is the theory of highly correlated conductors, and among those highly correlated conductors, especially the high-temperature superconductors. So the problem here is the following. In conventional metals, they're at high density. The kinetic energy is the dominant energy in the problem. You include the effects of interactions as an afterthought, sometimes an important afterthought, but there's no doubt that the theory is dominated by the kinetic energy. You should think of things in K-space. And on the other hand, in correlated insulators, you, say, put one electron on each atom, which minimizes the interaction energy. There, it's clear the interaction energy is the dominant energy in the problem, and you can include the kinetic energy as an afterthought through super exchange or something like that. And again, that very description, the language we use to describe it, is a real space picture, and it's very hard to understand the structure of correlated insulators in K-space, the natural places in real space. Now, what happens with highly correlated conductors is that they're conductors, so things move around. So it's obvious you can't include the kinetic energy as an afterthought. And on the other hand, they're highly correlated, which means the interactions are very strong and have qualitative effects. And so you can't include that as an afterthought. And so it's just a hard problem. The particular class of highly correlated insulators that I've been thinking about for a long time, along with much of the condensed matter community, are doped antiferromagnets, again, especially the high-temperature superconductors. And so much of what I'm going to discuss is going to be focusing on the issue of what happens when you dope an antiferromagnet. Now, I'll define all those terms for those of you who aren't familiar with them. Now, let me also say what we mean by understanding, what sort of answers do we want to the question of, you know, how do you understand these things? And so, of course, one thing that we want to understand is what are the fixed points, what are the stable phases, for instance. And so here I have some sort of schematic phase diagram where this is the electron density and this is the temperature. And so at low electron density, the interactions dominate and we're going to have a Mott or Wigner insulator of some sort. At very high electron density, we have a Fermi liquid or generally, you know, more familiar metallic phenomena. And so the sharp question you can ask about highly correlated conductors are there distinct intermediate phases? But there's another sort of question that we're also interested in, which is a quantitative question. We know that when you turn on interactions in a conventional metal, you get superconductivity, or you can. And the same is true in the high-temperature superconductors, and you might say a superconductor is a superconductor, but TC is an order of magnitude larger. And so there's a quantitative question that's nonetheless qualitative because it's such a big number, 10, which is why is TC so much higher in these materials? And, you know, that's actually not a very popular viewpoint, I think you ask most condensed matter physicists, theorists who are not actively working in high TC, what's the one thing about the high temperature superconductors that's uninteresting? They will uniformly answer TC. But I think that's not really a viable position. Okay, so that's... Okay, so what do we mean by doping, first place? Well, doping means we have something which is an insulator and we add something called charge to it. And so then we end up with a doped insulator. So charge generally could just be any conserved quantity that I add to the system. And sometimes that will be charge in the sense of something that has long-range Coulomb interactions, and sometimes it won't be. And then an insulator is simply something that has a gap in its charge excitation spectrum. Okay, but within the rubric of insulators, there are two very different types of insulators. They're things that are insulating for different reasons. One we call band insulators, which are insulating even when you turn off all interactions in the problem. So that's something like silicon or something like the Dirac vacuum. And the other are correlated insulators, which are insulators for some other reason. Now, usually associated with correlated insulators, we find that there's some other way that you can describe the insulating ground state. There's usually a condensate of some sort. There is often a broken symmetry. And so these give us some handles on describing the low energy physics of correlated insulators. Okay, and so here are some examples of correlated insulators. Polyacetylene, which is a one-dimensional electron phonon system. The commensurate one-dimensional electron gas. The antiferromagnet that I've already mentioned, and a quantum Hall liquid, which is an incompressible state, so it's got a gap. And all of these things exhibit topological doping, so that's why they're up there. Okay, so what happens when you dope a band insulator? Well, it's really pretty simple. You have, say, some density of states in the insulating state. And then if you add electrons, you move the chemical potential up into the conduction band. And if you add holes or remove electrons, you move the chemical potential down into the valence band. But the density of states and the structure of the state stays more or less the same. And you've just filled states differently, which allows it to conduct. Here I've shown what maybe happens to the optical absorption spectrum, even in the doped state. So you get some new low energy response of the system, but you still see the unchanged insulating response of the system. Okay, so now let me describe the simplest example of doping a correlated insulator, which is soliton doping of polyacetylene. And so let me just describe to you for a moment what polyacetylene is. Polyacetylene is some long one-dimensional molecule, which I've shown is this zigzag here. The important point is that there's one electron per unit cell until the system chooses to break a symmetry and dimerizes. And it can dimerize this way or it can dimerize that way. By doing that, polyacetylene becomes an insulator, but it's a correlated insulator in the sense that it's this interaction, the electron-phonon interaction, that causes it to be an insulator, and there is an associated broken symmetry, which is, in this case, manifests by the twofold degenerate ground state. So then you can ask, what happens if I add electrons to this system or remove electrons? And one thing you could imagine doing is just keeping the structure more or less the same and putting the electron into an extended state, which by Bloch's theorem would mean a state of some given K. And that costs an energy per added charge of something called the gap. The gap is the thing that defines the insulating state. It makes it insulating, but it also reflects the fact that it costs a lot of energy to put charges into the system. X here is the concentration of added charges. Okay, well, you can imagine doing something else. You could imagine in some region of space destroying the insulating order so the system becomes metallic, and then you can put the added charges in for free. Now, of course, the price you have to pay is you have to destroy the correlations in the of the insulator. And you can do that in one of two ways. You can do it the way I've done here, which is to make a soliton, where that is to say a domain wall between the two degenerate vacuums. Or you could do it in a topologically trivial way, that is to make what we call a polaron. And in this case, you can calculate the energies of all of these defects. And it turns out that the topological defect is the cheapest way of adding charge to the system. So as you add charge to the system, you generate these topological defects. Okay, so that's a fact. That's observed in experiments. It's a little bit unsettling that that fact turns on a number. It turns on the fact that 2 over pi is smaller than 1 over the square root of 2. In fact, that's something that runs through all of this talk. There are no, you know, analytic things. There are no logarithms or anything like that that are going to favor topological doping over trivial doping. It just seems to win in a lot of cases. So what happens as you dope is you make some concentration of these topological defects in the system. And then there are many consequences that follow very directly from that. One thing is that you have this ground state with long-range order. You put in a very small amount of doping, and you completely destroy the long-range order, because these topological defects are extremely effective at disordering the system. In fact, they are what prevent a one-dimensional system from having broken symmetry at finite temperature. So when you introduce them by doping, they have the same effect, more or less. The other thing is that what happens is sort of the opposite of what happens when you dope a band insulator. Rather than moving the chemical potential and keeping the density of states fixed, you move the density of states and keep the chemical potential more or less fixed. The chemical potential stays in the gap, and you simply move states into the gap. So the optical absorption spectrum of polyacetylene, here's the insulator, and here's the doped system, reflecting the fact that there's just a change in the density of states. Now, on the other hand, although one has destroyed the long-range order, it's clear that from the local character of these defects that most of the system still has local correlations that look like the insulating state. And so although you very rapidly destroy the long-range order on doping, you preserve various consequences of the short-range correlations. For instance, in this case, although you remove the charge gap in the system immediately on doping, you retain the spin gap of the insulating state as you dope. And then finally, there's a notion here that's sort of implicit in all of this discussion, that this picture can only be valid at low enough doping such that the solitons are more than a soliton width apart. And so there's a notion, the moment you're thinking about doping with topological defects, that at low enough concentration of added charge, you have a doped insulator, which still looks locally like the insulator, whereas for doping concentration bigger than the critical concentration, the system is somehow overdoped and loses memory of the fact that it was once an insulator. Okay, and I won't bore you with that, but that's all seen rather explicitly and in, you know, pretty good detail in experiment in polyacetylene, which is some gloppy conducting polymer, sort of disgusting stuff, but they're nice experiments. Okay, so that was my first example. That's an old example. Let me now discuss the more topical and more interesting example of doping an antiferromagnet. Now, with high temperature superconductivity in mind, I'm going to be imagining a two-dimensional antiferromagnet, but the same considerations apply in three dimensions. I'll talk about that a little. And in fact, in any dimension, one of the handles we've had on solving problems like this is to go to the limit of large dimension. And there you can see all these phenomena occur, again, very explicitly. So you have a small parameter. So here's a picture of the insulating state. This is an antiferromagnetic insulator. I imagine, since it's the insulator, I consider the interactions first. So there's a very big energy that forbids there to be two electrons on any given site. That's why each of these sites, which is somehow supposed to represent an atom, maybe copper, has one electron on it. But there's still the spins of the electrons. And the spins get coupled when you include the kinetic energy and singular perturbation theory. And then, miraculously, the system realizes that to be an insulator, it really would like to have two electrons per unit cell. So it goes into this broken symmetry state, which breaks translation symmetry, so there are now two atoms per unit cell, so there are an even number of electrons per unit cell. And it also breaks spin rotation symmetry. So there's the antiferromagnet. Okay, now what happens, well, there's large numbers of materials that exhibit antiferromagnetic insulating states, and many of the best are metal oxide systems, and I'm going to be talking about explicit examples of many metal oxide systems. In particular, those are systems in which one can readily also dope this antiferromagnet. And so let me just describe what is now known to happen in some of these. Okay, now, you know, these long chemical formulas are there mostly to try to intimidate you. But these are names of particular metal oxides that exhibit that are doped antiferromagnets. These top two are in the family of high-temperature superconductors and are, in fact, high-temperature superconductors. And these latter two are extremely good insulators, even when doped. Well, not extremely good, but pretty good insulators. But what happens in all these cases is shown in this picture below. So there's a lot going on in this picture. First, the green stuff is charge. So what happens is the charge doesn't get distributed uniformly through the system. It clumps up, and it clumps up into lines in two dimensions. Now, I have these little annotations next to it. These materials are layered, so thinking of them as two-dimensional is reasonable. This material is nearly cubic, and so you should think of this as simply being a top view of this antiferromagnet. These are now sheets of charge. I'm going to refer to all of these things as stripes. Yes? In this? Well, in fact, that's how the stripes were first observed. They take 1,000 angstrom films, and they look at the stripes by electron transmission. So if the stripes weren't absolutely in registry over the full 1,000 angstrom thickness, you wouldn't see it. So it's, I would say, of anything you could ask me, this is the one I'm most confident of. Now, these are very beautiful experiments by Chong. I should say, I couldn't figure out what to do about referencing. There's, first place, lots of experiments and lots of theories I'm referring to, and all of them have many different parents and complicated histories. So I haven't, well, occasionally at random I put in a reference, but there's no systematic referencing. And if you want to know about, you know, who did what and, you know, who gets credit and so on, you can ask me and I'll have an opinion whether it's right or wrong. But I apologize that this is going to be completely without footnotes. Okay, so in all of these systems, the charges do this. Now, the magnetic order is also doing something. What you can see is if I hadn't doped the system, the spins would go up, down, up, down. So what's happened is the spin order has been shifted by 180 degrees. These are pi domain walls in the antiferromagnetic order. Okay? Well, then there's this other annotation over here that means met means metal and insul means insulator. These stripes of metal can either be insulating, in which case there really are no important degrees of freedom here. It's just it's charged, but there's nothing moving. Or they can be metallic and even superconducting, in which case there are other important low-energy degrees of freedom that I haven't shown in the picture having to do with the electrons moving up and down these stripes. Okay. Good. Let me just complete this survey with a couple of other examples. This is sort of an aside from the subject of doped antiferromagnets, but it's just trying to convince you that this notion of topological doping occurs in a lot of different types of systems. So I'm going to look at a doped ferromagnet, and in this case I'm going to look, in fact, at a doped quantum Hall ferromagnet. So if you remember, I have a two-dimensional electron gas in a magnetic field. If I ignore interactions, the spectrum is Landau levels. So here's a lower Landau level, lowest Landau level with spin-up electrons. Here's a lowest Landau level with spin-down electrons. And then here's the second Landau level for spin-up electrons and so on. Now, this would be a bit, if I'm at a density such that I can just fill this one level, this would, of course, be a band insulator because it's an insulator in the absence of interactions. But it turns out that in gallium arsenide, which is where most of these experiments are done, this Zeeman splitting between the spin-up and spin-down electrons is very small. In fact, it's small compared to the observed gap in the spectrum. So, in fact, to a good approximation, you can imagine that the Zeeman energy is zero, and that this thing is a spontaneous ferromagnet, and that it's therefore a correlated insulator. And that viewpoint turns out to be productive because what you, of course, know is for a two-dimensional Heisenberg system, there are a interesting class of topological defects. I think you coined the word baby skirmions. Anyway, there are baby skirmions, which, of course, normally are some very high-energy excitation and which are, moreover, don't know how to select any particular size, so they don't have any particular stability. But when we dope the system, it turns out that you couple the charge to the skirmion density, you produce skirmions in direct proportion to the charge, in fact, one for every charge that you add to the system, and the size of this skirmion is stable It's selected by a competition between the small Zeeman energy, which favors it to be as small as possible, and the Coulomb energy, which favors it to be as big as possible. Another example are just conventional quantum Hall liquids, which are, again, incompressible states, so they're insulators. They're described by the so-called Girvan-McDonald order parameter, and in this language, the Laughlin quasiparticles appear as vortices. And again, a vortex would normally be a high energy excitation of this system, and you wouldn't see it in the ground state, but when you dope, the process of doping forces a certain concentration of these vortices into the ground state. And finally, there's, well, soliton doping for one-dimensional electron gas. Okay. So now, having given you a number of examples, let me tell you what this idea of topological doping is. So there are three thoughts here, which sort of are themes running through all the examples that I've just given you. First, that doping a correlated insulator produces a density of topological defects in the insulating order with a density proportional to the doping concentration. The charge is then accommodated inside those topological defects. Now, the second is that the charge stabilizes these topological defects. In many cases, the topological defects I've described would be stable, but they would be, that is to say, would be metastable states, but they would be high energy excited states of the system. And by doping, you force them into the ground state, so you energetically stabilize them. But in some cases, like this domain wall in an antiferromagnet, it's certainly topological. The order changes as you go across it, but it's not the sort of natural topological defect you would have thought of when you were thinking about something with Heisenberg symmetry. You would have thought of, well, various things that twist and turn, but certainly not an Ising-like domain wall. So it can end up stabilizing classes of topological defects that probably wouldn't even be metastable in the absence of doping. And then finally, the probably phenomenologically the most important thing and the most important thing in suggesting, in understanding the importance of this for understanding highly correlated conductors is that it produces a doped insulating state which is not spatially homogeneous. The charge is globbed up in some sort of extended defects of some sort, at least on intermediate time and length scales. I mean, we have to ask what the dynamics of these defects are before we know whether this is really static order or not. And it suggests that rather than what we do in conventional solid state physics is looking at the properties of quasiparticles, which more or less correspond to electrons, in doped insulators, we should be thinking about the collective modes associated with the motion of these extended objects. And that's really the most important conclusion. Okay, so that's actually my summary slide. But now let me try to tell you why this happens. Okay, so I've sort of told you in sort of loose physical terms, the insulating order tends to expel charge. That's why it's insulating. And therefore, it's very natural to expect some sort of self-trapping when you dope. You want to suppress the insulating order and put the charge where the order is suppressed. Well, then once you realize that, why not share regions of suppressed order? So when you put in one charge, the next charge would like to go where the insulating order is already suppressed, so you might expect that you're going to form some sort of bubbles in which many of the added charges glob up. And then once you think of that, you sort of think that, well, what's going to stop this process? It's probably going to go all the way and the system's going to phase separate. And it's an important perspective that I find that at least most condensed matter theorists don't have, that, in fact, that is what you should expect in general, that when you try to mix two things and you cool them down, almost always what they do is they phase separate. Now, there are two things working against that. One is the Fermi pressure, but these are highly correlated systems, so the Fermi pressure isn't as big as you think it is. And the second is, of course, if these charges carry with them long-range Coulomb interactions, then, of course, you can't have a state that's macroscopically inhomogeneous, and so whatever tendency there is to phase separation is frustrated. Okay, so that explains why you would expect clumping of the charge. Now, why would you expect it to go on topological defects? Well, as I showed you in polyacetylene, that turned on a number. And in fact, if you think about it, it turns out it doesn't always want to go on a topological defect. This isn't the universal answer. So even within doped antiferromagnets, I lied to you a little. The order in lanthanum strontium copper oxide was just what I drew. Antiferromagnetism, charge, antiferromagnetism, pi phase shifted, charge, and so on. These are topological in, well, this is now a soliton lattice, but you can still tell that these are topological defects from the fact that the period of the charge order is half the period of the spin order. Is that clear? Okay. But in lanthanum manganate, it turns out you get double charges. In a sense, these stripes dimerize. But now the basic building block is this thing. And of course, since it's a double stripe, there are two pi phase shifts across this, so it's just not topological at all. There's actually a very interesting example of this in the quantum Hall ferromagnet. If you do this calculation in the lowest Landau level, you find out that the energy to add a skirmion is in fact lower than the energy to add a topologically trivial quasiparticle, so that's how you dope. But if you fill the lowest Landau level and try to repeat the story in the second Landau level, Shivaji Sandi and Wu showed that, in fact, the balance is reversed and that in all higher levels, the skirmion is higher energy than the quasiparticle. So when you dope, you produce quasiparticles instead of topological defects. Well, of course, the quasiparticles are vortices, but at least it's a different type of topological defect. Yeah, they're just accidents of numbers. I mean, you know, which Landau level you're in is just as disgusting a microscopic detail as you can imagine. It's what the wave function basis is in which you expand the Landau level.
It can be calculated analytically and so on.
Yeah, let's see. Yeah, they can be calculated analytically. That's what they did. So now what I'd like to do is to try to, repeat the words that I did in some sort of slightly more respectable form in terms of a Landau theory, which somehow, it's nothing more than the words I've just said, but let me go through it. It maybe gives some insight. It certainly gives some interesting results that I'll describe. So here's my Hamiltonian for the insulating state. So I'm imagining, well, that it's a Heisenberg model, for instance. But, you know, while I was at it, I've learned that you should just put N here. And so it's a O-N vector of some sort, and it's got some stiffness. And it's a soft spin, so this would like the magnitude of the spin to be 1. And then there's some other terms, which I'm not going to tell you about, although they're actually important for the stability of some of the things I'm going to tell you about, but I'm going to hide them. And then I wanted to couple in the charge, so I imagined I have a charge density rho, and since rho has to be positive, I decided rho should be phi squared. What isn't at all obvious is that I should be able to describe the energy for spatial variations of rho this way, but it was the easiest thing I could do, so I did it. So here's the compressibility of this system left to its own devices. And then this is the term that says where the magnetic order is, the charge doesn't like to be. And maybe if you want to quantize this system, you can put in some kinetic energy. Okay? And now what I want to do is force some charge into the system. So I'm going to say, okay, the ground state maybe is just S equals 1 and rho equals 0, but I'm now going to force Q to be different than 0, and I'm going to look for different classical ground states. So to start with, I'm going to set T equals 0 and H bar equal to 0, and make Q something not 0 but not too big. Okay, and so then, well, that's a fairly simple problem. And first place, you find that phase separation is the global minimum. That's not that interesting. But what you find is that despite the fact that this is an ON model, and you might not think that an Ising-like amplitude soliton has any business existing, you find that an amplitude soliton lattice is metastable. It's both metastable locally in the sense that the energy goes up if you try to, say, make this spin grow a little pointing out this way. So you try to turn it into a spiral. But it's also metastable in the sense that the interactions between the solitons at long distances is repulsive. So that they don't know that globally they would do better off grabbing together and phase separating. It doesn't.
Square,
pi square. What?
S
yeah.
Square means S dot S.
S dot S. It means this.
Pi square.
Yeah.
Pi knows about the direction.
No, it doesn't know about the direction.
Why does phi care about the thing's diameter?
No. So phi would like S to be small.
Mm-hmm.
On the other hand, this term would like S to be 1.
Right.
Okay. Now, if I tried to make, say, suppose I take an ordinary Heisenberg magnet and I put spin up boundary conditions on this side and spin down boundary conditions on this side. Surely it could form an amplitude soliton where the magnitude of the spin went to 0 and then picked up negative on the other side. But you would expect in most cases that that wouldn't be what it would like to do. What it would like to do instead, in fact, I think what it would always like to do instead, is to simply rotate across the whole system. That costs no energy in the thermodynamic limit. So it's clear that in the absence of the charge, that would be stable. And so you might worry, or let's put it this way, I was worried that even though phi squared favors S vanishing, that the fact that S wanted to be big would make it always decide to spiral instead of do this Ising-like thing. Okay, but it will do this Ising-like thing, and also the soliton lattice itself is metastable in the sense that there are repulsive interactions between these objects. And then the final thing is if you look at the normal modes about this, you find that all the modes involving charge density oscillations are gapped. So this is a description of a insulating stripe phase. Each stripe picks to have the density it likes best, whatever that is, that's determined by these coupling constants, and then it sticks with that. Okay, now, you can go a little bit further with this. You can ask what happens if you do quantum fluctuations for small h bar about this. I haven't actually done that, but Leonid and Dan Hone and I did a calculation which I claim is the moral equivalent of it. And what you find is that, I guess it was supposed to be an H bar there. That in addition to this classical repulsion between the solitons, there is a Casimir force between them that causes them to want to attract. So, in fact, even here, you can't even quite make the soliton lattice metastable. It always, at low enough concentration, wants to collapse. Again, as with all of the bad things I found, the Coulomb interactions is clearly going to stop that.
Collapse means the stripes that they're at?
No. So, I start with very low doping concentration. The stripes are very far apart. But they attract each other, so that means that I'm going to have probably a high density strike phase. I mean, there's no reason to expect it's not, you know, at some distance, at least if H bar is small, these will collapse until they're a distance apart so that these two forces counteract each other. But the system is homogeneous. There's inhomogeneous. There's stripes at that density over here and then no stripes over there.
So it phase
separates into a stripe phase.
I'm a little confused. When they get really close together, it's attractive again, right?
When they get really close together, it's attractive again.
So how do you know that this... So now I have attraction at long distance, attraction at short distance, and you think maybe repulsion in the middle.
No. I know repulsion. We've calculated it.
Oh, I
mean, it's simple. It's a simple... I mean, it's a, not simple. It's, but it's analytic, you know. It just takes a little work.
Okay.
So and so the correct statement is it's metastable. It's not stable, but there will be a dense soliton lattice that's at least metastable, or might be stable on a finite size system or something. Okay, so this Coulomb interaction certainly is going to stabilize the soliton lattice both against phase separation and against this sort of phase separation into a dense soliton lattice. So that gets rid of, if we put in the long-range Coulomb interactions, that gets rid of that problem. But we believe, and I'm just not going to go into this now, that it also solves the problem of making the stripes compressible. Basically, now the density on each stripe isn't chosen by the local physics to be exactly what it wants to be and immovable. It's affected by the long-range physics, so that means you can make small changes in the density with no cost and energy. Okay, so that's one view of how the tendency of the antiferromagnet to expel charge causes you to get topological doping. There's an even cruder Landau theory that one can write down, which focuses from the beginning on this effect of the Coulomb interaction. So I want to just describe an even cruder level of Landau theory, but one that's applicable to an enormous variety of systems. And so what I want to imagine is I have a system that has a local tendency to phase separation. So this is, I've integrated out the antiferromagnet in some way, and what I find is all that's left is that the holes want to glob up. They want to glob up because that's where the antiferromagnetism is suppressed, but I've thrown that part of the physics away. And then I put on the long-range Coulomb interaction, or I can write down a lattice model of this with a short-range ferromagnetic interaction and a long-range antiferromagnetic interaction. And, well, we studied this in this context, but it turns out this is a model that's been studied very extensively in trying to understand pattern formation in a host of systems with competing interactions. And what comes out is stripes. Stripe liquids, stripe crystals, stripe glasses, but stripes, they just come out all over the place. There you go. Look at that. No, this is experiments, actually. This is ferrofluid. I don't even actually know what ferrofluid is. I did once when I read this article, but I've forgotten. Confined between two plates of glass, and the length scale here is 1 centimeter. And here is magnetic textures in a what? These are imaged in different ways. So here, what you're doing is that these are regions of spin up, and these are regions of spin down. But it doesn't matter. You see them with optical rotation. But it doesn't matter. The important point is whenever you have a system with competing interactions like this, with a short-range ferromagnetic interaction and a long-range antiferromagnetic interaction, well, what you always get are inhomogeneous structures. But 9 times out of 10, you get things that sort of look like stripes. Okay, David Nelson told me about this when I was talking to him about these things, and seeing them, I don't know, sort of nice.
Did you speak the classically?
Classically. Yeah.
There's no quantum fluctuation.
Yeah, now, of course, what you get is actually ordered stripes out of the Landau theory, and, of course, that's not what you see here. And they have all sorts of excuses for that having to do with this being disrupted by non-equilibrium phenomena. But I suspect they're wrong. I suspect it's not quantum in this case, but thermal fluctuations have disordered the system. But, you know, be that as it may, the important point is that this competition between a local tendency to phase separation and long-range Coulomb interactions certainly does produce these sorts of local structures. Okay, so so far it's all been descriptive. Well, maybe we've explained some phenomena that occur, but we're, of course, we're excited about this because we think that this is good for something, and that's the part of the theory that's the least developed. But let me describe what I think this observation is good for. And I'm now going to strip away all pretense of generality and talk only about doped antiferromagnets. So the first thing I've said before is that we're dealing now with new variables. We're dealing with the dynamics of collective defects, not with the dynamics of electrons when we're looking at a doped antiferromagnet. There's a very important distinction when we're looking at stripes between insulating stripes in which the picture tells you all the important degrees of freedom. So there, you should study the system by just studying the motions of the stripes and the interactions between stripes, but they can be treated as more or less featureless, versus metallic stripes where you have to worry about the electronic degrees of freedom living on the stripes and the interplay between the dynamics of the stripes and the dynamics of the electrons within the stripes. And for the high-temperature superconductors, this is clearly, they're clearly metallic stripes, and this is clearly important. Now, this gives you a handle on at least imagining...
The last statement is theoretical fact?
No, that's an experimental fact. Long-range stripe order coexists with both metallic conduction at high temperatures and superconductivity at low temperatures. So the stripes aren't moving, so there's got to be other degrees of freedom that are moving. Yes? What? Well, lanthanum, neodymium, strontium copper oxide, and lanthanum 1.88, strontium 0.12 copper oxide. There's a very recent PhysRevB on that. That is to say, what they see is Bragg peaks in neutron and X-ray scattering corresponding to stripe order and superconductivity. And both are believed to be bulk.
Okay. Is it got weak superconductivity?
I mean, it's not anywhere near the maximum. It's weak by the high TC standards. I think the lanthanum strontium copper oxide material has something like a 30-some-odd degree superconducting transition, so it's not 100 or 150, but it's certainly pretty respectable.
Are you actually seeing it in that region?
Yeah. In the lanthanum neodymium strontium copper oxide, TC is more suppressed, but this recent paper by Yamada on lanthanum 2 minus X, strontium X, CuO4, no neodymium, with X equals 0.12. This has about a 30-some-odd degree transition temperature, and they've seen magnetic Bragg peaks. What? A little bit off from what? From 0.12?
Yeah.
Well, what happens is there is a weak signature in the superconductivity in this material. There's sort of a shoulder at 1/8 doping. But the magnetic scattering is very singular at this point. This is where you see Bragg peaks. On either side of it, you see sharp inelastic peaks with a very long correlation length, but no Bragg scattering. So what's somehow happening is that in this neighborhood, the stripes are slowly fluctuating. At this commensurate value, they get locked to the lattice, so they show up as Bragg peaks. But, you know, from the point of view of superconductivity, it doesn't make much difference whether you have ordered stripes or slowly fluctuating stripes. And that's seen in experiment. Okay. So this gives you a handle on at least dreaming up intermediate phases of matter, new phases of matter, using these stripes as building blocks. So at least you can set up targets for people to shoot at. You know, you talk about intermediate states of matter all you want, but until you have a concrete candidate, it's hard to rule it out. So once you start thinking of stripes, you can start thinking of stripe crystals. Well, those have been seen. That's maybe not so exotic. That's just some complicated form of coupled charge and spin density wave. You know, I may personally think it's exciting, but then you can imagine various states where the stripes still have a lot of integrity and a lot of short-range order, but are not crystalline. So you can imagine stripe liquid phases and stripe liquid crystal phases, and I'll talk a little about that. But those would be distinct states of matter that you can now envisage. Okay, so those are good. Now, I actually think the most deep and important question is what happens to these highly correlated materials at high temperatures? The reason I think that is they all behave the same, whether they're quasi-one-dimensional, quasi-two-dimensional, three-dimensional, whether they ultimately become superconductors, charge density wave insulators, ferromagnets. These low electron density materials have very, very common and very anomalous behavior at high temperatures that I claim to have achieved an exquisite level of not understanding, and which I'll share with you sometime if you ask. And maybe some vestige of these stripes, certainly not much order, but maybe the notion of local inhomogeneities is where one could ultimately get a key to where that comes from. All right, so I started at 10 past. Can I go on for another 5 minutes or so? Is that okay? I got no response, but I'm used to that, you know.
I saw David Gross nodding his head.
Okay, good, okay. So, yeah, you know, when I teach, I ask, you know, does anybody understand this? Nobody responds. Does anybody not understand this?
Ask us the same question.
Okay, does anybody? No, it's too depressing. I'm not going to ask. Okay, so let me describe work we've done to show that theoretically a new state of matter, namely the two-dimensional electronic smectic phase, is a conceivable, stable ground state phase. That is to say, what we've showed is that there exists a stable fixed point corresponding to this phase. Okay? Then it's sort of up to experiments whether they want to have it exist or not. So let me think first about a single metallic stripe in isolation. Since it's living in an insulator, then the electronic degrees of freedom that move up and down it are a one-dimensional electron gas. And we know lots and lots about the one-dimensional electron gas. And in particular, we know that there are all sorts of susceptibilities that have power law behavior at low temperatures. So here's a susceptibility going like some exponent, where x alpha are different exponents for CDW, SDW, superconducting, and so on. But one thing we know for the one-dimensional electron gas is no matter how you shake and bake it, one of these susceptibilities always diverges. Okay? So that means that all of this beautiful, exotic, Luttinger liquid, non-Fermi liquid physics of one dimension is immediately unstable when you have even arbitrarily weak couplings in two dimensions. So if I imagine now a quasi-one-dimensional crystal, so I take a bunch of these one-dimensional electron gases, I turn on weak couplings between them, though one or the other of those weak couplings will be perturbatively relevant, or sort of in a more mundane way, one can imagine doing an inner stripe mean field theory of the sort that I think Doug Scalapino introduced first, where you J alpha is the coupling of this type of order parameter on neighboring stripes, and so chi is the one-dimensional susceptibility, and you ask, when does the susceptibility times the coupling constant equal to 1? That gives you a TC. And so not only does that mean since this diverges, you'll always get a TC no matter how weak the coupling is. And so that's bad if you like exotic physics. There's another problem, which is in the one-dimensional electron gas, at least with repulsive interactions, you almost always find that either the CDW or the SDW susceptibility is the most divergent. So not only is this going to go into a mundane long-range ordered state, but it's going to be an insulating state, not a superconducting state. And, you know, if you're thinking that high-temperature superconductivity is nice, that's not good. And so here you can see I've shown that the electrons on neighboring stripes are locked in registry, and that's bad. Okay. Now, let me describe pictorially why this bad thing doesn't happen necessarily in a quantum mechanical stripe phase. So here, because my stripe phase is quantum mechanical, the stripes themselves are dynamical, and so they're fluctuating. So I've drawn three neighboring stripes, and now I've tried to lock up the charge density wave on neighboring stripes. So on this stripe, the electrons are trying to be equally spaced as they go along, and on this stripe, they're trying to be equally spaced as you go along. And what you can see is that because the arc length along this stripe and along that stripe are different, if I lock them into registry here, they're going to fall out of registry all over the place as you go on into the system. So if I do things in the following order, I first let the stripes fluctuate, look at the ground state, ignoring the coupling between the electronic degrees of freedom on the stripe. Then I turn on the coupling between stripes and perturbation theory. I will find that it's perturbatively irrelevant. Now, that doesn't mean it's always going to be irrelevant, of course. The system is going to choose between the nice zero-point energy it gets by having the stripes fluctuate and the nice Coulomb energy it gets by locking the charge density waves into registry. So there'll be a first-order transition, but as long as we're on the right side of that transition, this state in which the electrons remain liquid-like along the stripes remains perturbatively stable. Now, that suppresses charge density wave ordering and spin density wave ordering on neighboring stripes, which are short wavelength orders, and so they can be knocked out of registry. It doesn't do anything bad for superconductivity, which is a k equals zero fluctuation on each stripe, so it really doesn't care what the arc length is. In fact, these stripe fluctuations help superconductivity because superconducting coupling between neighboring stripes occurs by pair tunneling. So if the stripes set static, you had to tunnel across a long distance, whereas if they fluctuate, sometimes the stripes get close together, and so you get, if you want, an inverse Biwaller factor for the superconducting tunneling, which enhances the Josephson coupling between neighboring stripes.
Between the stripes, do you have some kind of insulator?
Some kind of insulator, yeah. Okay. I mean, in this model, I've got a featureless insulator. Now, in reality, I have something with antiferromagnetic fluctuations, and I haven't solved that. So here we just have stripes living in a featureless insulator and fluctuating and tunneling and so on. Okay, good. So I'm now going to end with, I mean, I've shown an intermediate phase exists, so why not speculate about lots more? And I stress that this is pure speculation. So here, I imagine I have some quantum parameter determining how quantum mechanical the stripes are, presumably. And here I have temperature, but let's first go along the zero temperature axis. When they're very unquantum, I have a stripe-ordered phase and very little fluctuations, so the electronic degrees of freedom that live on the stripe are locked to each other, and so I have a quantum solid. It's an insulating crystal phase. But then, when the quantum parameter gets big enough, I still have an ordered phase of stripes. Their spacing is not disordered, but they're just fluctuating enough about their equilibrium position that the electronic degrees of freedom along the stripe are liberated. So now I have a system that's crystalline in one direction. It's broken translational symmetry by ordering the stripes, but liquid in the other direction. So that's a quantum analog of a smectic phase. Then Here's a picture of it. Now you can imagine turning up quantum fluctuations enough that I guess you start getting dislocations, but that the stripes are still more or less going up, down, and not right, left. So the stripes spontaneously break rotational symmetry, and we have a quantum pneumatic phase. And finally, maybe they get wildly enough fluctuating that we get disclinations generated, and then we will have a liquid phase. But it's a liquid phase which has uncoupled one-dimensional electron gases living in it, so it's a non-Fermi liquid phase. Of course, it's pretty far from anywhere where I can control the calculation. Okay, so thank you.
I've been thinking about that.
Let me describe the question. So here I've imagined that I had a rigid lattice and I was only taking into account the electronic degrees of freedom and that they spontaneously broke rotational symmetry. But of course, that will couple to a lattice distortion. So if you had an electronic phase like this, it would drive the system from a tetragonal state, tetragonal means it looks like a square, to an orthorhombic state. Orthorhombic means it looks like a rectangle. Okay, so that's the good news. They do see tetragonal to orthorhombic transitions in this. On the other hand, if the lattice wants to go from tetragonal to orthorhombic, it will induce electronic anisotropies in the system. So you have to have some opinion on which is the chicken and which is the egg. Let me say that in many of these systems, a very small amount of lattice orthorhombicity produces an enormous electronic anisotropy. So, for instance, in YBCO, in which one believes that most things are still going to go on in the planes, at least I believe that, you get a factor of 2 or even as much as a factor of 10 anisotropy in the superfluid density. Now, if you want to explain the factor of 10 in terms of a parallel conduction in the chains, you have to imagine that there's 10 times as much superfluid density in the chains and the planes, and that just doesn't compute for me. Yeah.
Yeah, well, look, the whole point is there isn't an absolute answer.
That is to say, you take these models, like, for instance, this model of frustrated phase separation on a lattice. So I take, So if you look at this model, I am answering your question, just bear with me. And you solve its ground state phase diagram as a function of Q. Okay, so for Q really big, what you find is a nail state. I'm going to solve this on a square lattice. Well, that's just because that's what we happen to have solved it on. Okay? On the other hand, if Q were 0, you would get a ferromagnet, which is to say phase separation. So if I think of up as the whole free regions and down as the whole rich regions. Okay? Now you look at the phase diagram as a function of Q, and it basically looks like this. Here's the nail state at big Q, and big Q is big, I don't know, 100 or something like that. Here are stripe phases of period that diverges as Q goes to 0 and gets smaller and smaller as Q gets bigger and bigger. Nothing particularly interesting, no devil staircases or anything, but just a sequence of stripe phases.
And in here, you get checkerboard phases, which are your droplets. So you get a phase, for instance, with four spins up and four spins down, and you know. So other things happen, but it turns out that stripes are very, very good for Coulomb energy. They have very low Madelung constants. And so all things being equal, that's how the system solves the competing tendencies of trying to be inhomogeneous and also trying to be neutral. Okay?
Stephen, the lanthanum strontium copper oxide, say, was X less than 0.5.
Are we X less than 0.5 or 0.05?
0.15.
0.15, okay.
Less than 0.15. Am I to think from your discussion that the stripes that you might appear in that are to be possibly metallic in some generalized sense?
Yes.
Or do you think of them as being insulated?
No, I think in the high-temperature superconductors that the stripes are metallic.
And what do you say about the Bollinger's data where he can turn on a magnetic field and quench the superconductor, and it appears, at least in the lanthanum strontium material, but below that doping, it looks like he has an insulating.
Yeah. We have to be careful about this. By insulating, I mean, these are complicated systems. There's long-distance behavior. I know these are one-dimensional electron gases, but probably electrons are localized at long distances. What I want to really distinguish is, does it have a gap, or does it have lots and lots of low-energy electronic degrees of freedom? Okay, so Bollinger, it's true, sees the resistance increasing, but it's a logarithm. Okay? Logarithm is metallic behavior in my book.
I would like to ask you, have you any idea why Brad Crouch or something like this is in favor of ITC?
Yes. Yeah, well, you know, that's a long subject. I'll summarize it. Okay? What? That's okay. I'll make it really short. There is an old story that one dimension looks good for superconductivity. This is an idea that's been around for a long time. It's led to lots of interesting physics in the physics of quasi-one-dimensional solids, but they always became insulators. Now, the short answer is that I think the reasons that people had for thinking that one dimension was a good place to look for superconductivity were right. There are large superconducting fluctuations that can occur on much higher scales than in higher dimensional systems. We can talk about why. But more or less for old reasons, but that the same reasons always produce the dominant charge density wave or spin density wave fluctuations, and therefore, although those superconducting fluctuations were just there waiting to do good, they were preempted by the insulating order. And that here we've finally gotten to a state where our quasi-one-dimensional system is sufficiently disordered in the right way, smoothly disordered, that the subdominant superconducting fluctuations on the stripes can be expressed. And so then that also says that there's going to be a delicate balance. C.X. Shen uses the words a love-hate relation, and I think Doug's been quoted as saying something about tickling the tail of the dragon. Is that right? But that you want the stripes there to get these nice one-dimensional correlations that are good locally for superconductivity, but you don't want them to be too static because then you're going to get an insulator. And so they've got to be there, but not too much.
What do you mean?
You mean no experimental evidence? There's no experiments. I mean, there's no neutron scattering. There's no photo emission. There's no experiments that have any information about real space structure in those materials. But there's now compelling evidence in the lanthanum cuprate family, in the YBCO family, in the BISCO family, which are the only three families in which there is any Q-space information. So, you know, it's still certainly a logical possibility that it's not there, but I guess I would be shocked. No. There's neutron scattering from Herb Mook. There's sharp incommensurate peaks at just the same period as in lanthanum cuprate. Dynamical, not static, but... What? No, these are brand new. I mean, they've presumably been around, but they haven't been detected. Well, at least that's an element of faith, you know. Maybe the deconstructionists would have us believe otherwise. What?
Do you really need to have dynamic structure in order to have...
Well, look. I mean, you know, we're talking about stories now, but let me tell you my story. Here I've drawn a dashed line which I've labeled superconducting. And let me tell you the logic of that line. There's no theory, there's just logic. So here I imagine I have the stripes, and I imagine that there is a diverging superconducting susceptibility on the stripes. But if the stripes are not very dynamic, they stay pretty far apart from each other. So the Josephson coupling between stripes is small, the phase ordering temperature is low, and so TC is small. Now, as I make the stripes more and more quantum mechanical, they fluctuate more and more, they come closer and closer together, the bad CDW correlations are more and more suppressed, so TC rises. Then eventually, the stripes are fluctuating so much that they're not a well-defined concept anymore. They're fluctuating on frequencies, say, large compared to the spin gap, and then the whole thing goes away. What? I told you, this is my story. It happens in my story. I mean, you know, I'd love to do theory of this, but I don't yet know how. We're working on it.
Theory scenario.